From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Progressive politics in America. Left for Dead, we'll talk with Village Voice writer Michael Tomasky and Barbara Ehrenreich, and the musical satire of the Four Men. Oliver North calls them a very weird group.
A couple of announcements before we get going with the entertainment. There's a white Ford Fairlane in the Lexus-only section of the parking lot. Don't get up, you've already been towed. Covert Operations is having a bake sale. They don't say where. And there's a meeting Sunday of the elitist club, exclusionary chapter, xenophobic subcommittee, and no one is invited.
All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman. It's the same old story, the rich get richer, but now there's a new twist. The New York Times reports that while rich people are prospering, the working class and poor are losing income or stagnating, more so than at any time since World War II. The widening gap was discovered by the Census Bureau, but the Times says some of the increase might be due to new ways of collecting information. The paper says the first 2 years of the Clinton administration were good for the country's top 5% of households, with their income growing at a faster rate than during the Reagan era. And a day after House hearings, a Senate panel is set to hear testimony in the FBI files flap. Lawmakers are looking into why the White House obtained 408 FBI files, including those of some top Republicans. The GOP charges the Democrats were looking for dirt. Former White House Travel Office Director Billy Dale is among the witnesses scheduled to testify today. 7 months after the White House fired him in 1993, it asked the FBI for Dale's background file. No one has yet explained why. Bruce Lindsay always was there for Bill Clinton. He had Clinton's ear in 1980 when the young Arkansas governor's career hit the skids, and again in 92 when it soared. Now it's Clinton's turn to stand up for the man who's always stood by him. Prosecutors in the Little Rock, Arkansas trial of two bankers are poised to implicate Lindsay in what they say was an illegal transaction involving Clinton's 1990 campaign for governor. Although Lindsay does not face charges, a defense attorney in the case said yesterday the Clinton confidant will be named as an unindicted co-conspirator. And President Clinton is pledging an all-out effort to halt a rash of church burnings, saying the attacks should be of concern to people in all walks of life. Clinton said he would marshal more federal resources to help states prosecute those who burn churches, rebuild the churches, and prevent future fires. His administration is seeking a fund to guarantee up to $10 million in private loans for rebuilding burned churches and is distributing a church threat assessment guide to help communities protect places of worship. He still, though, has not answered the question as to why the FBI is not in charge of the investigation and why he hasn't called the burnings domestic terrorism. And abortion rights advocates won a rare victory in the Republican-controlled Congress as the Senate voted to allow abortions at U.S. military hospitals overseas. The 51-45 vote yesterday would repeal a new law banning those abortions. But first, the House and Senate must resolve their disagreement on the issue. Last month, a similar move in the House to overturn the abortion ban failed. Kate Michaelman, president of the National Abortion and Reproductive Rights Action League, called the vote a welcome break from Congress's unprecedented assaults on women's reproductive freedom. You're listening to Democracy Now! Left for Dead is the title of a new book that will certainly make waves in progressive circles. Michael Tomasky, the author, believes the left has dropped the ball on many of the most debated social issues of the day, including affirmative action, welfare reform, and immigration. But not all on the left are taking this critique lying down. Barbara Ehrenreich, author of The Snarling Citizen, dissected Tomasky's book in the most recent issue of the Progressive magazine. Her review was entitled, Why We're All a Bunch of Losers. Joining us to discuss the past, present, and future of the left in the United States are Michael Tomasky. He writes for The Village Voice and author of the new book, Left for Dead. And Barbara Ehrenreich, we welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
Well, why don't we begin with Michael Tomasky? Tell us about your thesis in the book, Left for Dead, The Life, Death, and Possible Resurrection of Progressive Politics in America.
Well, let me say first what the book is not. The book is not an all-out attack on the left, and it's not an attempt to say we're all a bunch of losers and everything is terrible and I wash my hands of this movement and it's lost. It's not an attempt to do that. It is rather an attempt to say, I still care about these movements and I still care about the success of the labor movement and women's rights movement and gay and lesbian movement and civil rights movements. I agree with the goals and care profoundly about seeing the left succeed. What I'm saying, though, in the book is I think we've chosen some strategies over the last few years that have not succeeded. And I don't think anybody can seriously say at this point, unfortunately, that we're in good position, that we're having a profound influence
Why don't you talk about some of those areas where you think progressives in this country have failed?
Well, I think the basic problem, which sort of is a thread that runs throughout the book, is that we're really just talking to ourselves these days. You know, we're not, you know, the rhetoric we've developed, the language we've developed, we're not really doing a very good job. We're not successfully reaching out to people who aren't part of the movements and part of the groups that constitute the left. Now, those movements are to some extent large and have a reasonably broad base in certain sections of the country, but comparatively speaking, you know, they are pretty small, you know, and we don't have a way of reaching out to the people, you know, just sort of ordinary middle Americans, whether they're black or white or northern or southern or what have you, that don't necessarily consider themselves a part of any left movement, but whose sympathy and support the movements need to have success.
Well, let me ask you specifically, for example, about immigration.
Uh-huh.
Bob Dole is vowing to take back control of the U.S. border with Mexico if he's elected. He voiced support for legislation that would let states deny public education to children of illegal immigrants.
Well, I think that's outrageous, and I said in the book that I think that's outrageous, and that I certainly, if I'd lived in California, would have voted against Prop 187. What I do think, however, is that, you know, and I talk at some length about Prop 187 in the book, what I do think is that the left strategies in trying to persuade people to vote against Prop 187 weren't terribly successful, obviously weren't successful, but you know, the reason they weren't successful, I don't think, is that they didn't show people where their interest lay in opposing Prop 187. Of course, I'm for generous levels of legal immigration and you know, I'm certainly for, you know, tolerance in respect to treatment of immigrations and
where do you think the progressive movement went wrong there? What do you think was the issue that they should not have focused on that they did?
Well, I think, you know, there was a general tone and one can pick this up in going back and reading through, you know, left-wing magazines and their coverage of the Prop 187 thing. There was a general tone that, you know, if you vote for this thing, you're racist and xenophobic, and that doesn't compel people. That doesn't convince people that you know, you have to reason with them and a little bit more compellingly than that.
What about affirmative action?
Well, affirmative action, I'm for, basically. I mean, I think it's done a lot of good things, and I outline those in the book. But I, you know, again, it's running into trouble again in California, and this new ballot referendum that's going to be on the ballot in the fall of this year looks like it's going to pass, unfortunately.
The California Civil Rights Initiative,
CCRI. Another thing that I would certainly vote against. But I say, let's look at what affirmative action has turned into and maybe try to figure out ways that we can tinker with it and adjust it to save it. And the main point that I come to is that affirmative action is currently constituted, has only the animus of white working class people because they see it as a program that is directed sort of against them. And the right, you know, God knows, we have to admit, the right has used that very point to, I think, tremendous effect. What if affirmative action were not explicitly class-based, because I think that would create some problems, but if it had a class criterion as well as racial and gender and ethnic criteria that it currently has, if it had a class criteria and white poor people were eligible for some of affirmative action's benefits, would that not make them feel as though they had a stake in the program? You know, it would have problems too. I'm not sure it's the perfect answer, but it's just something that I'm tossing out there as an idea that might work and that might bring people in a certain category who are very much against the policy now for it.
I mean, wouldn't that lead to the same kind of attitude that we see towards people on welfare? When you have poorer people, you don't give them any kind of special benefits. Wouldn't that be what white working class or poorer people would face if you started saying we must favor them, even if that is a good idea?
Well, I don't think so. I don't think you would definitely necessarily see that happening. Your suggestion is that because it would then be class based, that it would not have any real constituency to survive.
I mean, I don't know why it would have any more of one than there is for affirmative action right now.
Well, that's an interesting point, except that I do think that the groups that support it now would continue to support it, wouldn't they? I mean, you know, civil rights groups would support it, women's groups would support it, as they should, because they'd continue to be beneficiaries. But I also think that if, you know, the example I use in the book, you know, the son of the coal miner in eastern Kentucky, you know, could be a beneficiary of this program, I think that over time, you know, people in that category might come to see that there's something in it for them.
Michael Tomasky is author of a new book called Left for Dead, The Life, Death, and Possible Resurrection of Progressive Politics in America. And we're joined on the phone from Florida by Barbara Ehrenreich, who reviewed Michael's book in the Progressive magazine. Barbara, your reaction to some of these thoughts being put forward by Michael?
Well, first, I have to say it must be a nightmare for an author to have to confront a reviewer during a book tour. There are, you know, areas which I agree with his book. I think that it's a ridiculous kind of postmodernism has somehow disguised itself as a left on college campuses, that a certain kind of political correctness or moral righteousness, as he says, sometimes substitutes for real argument. You know, there are lots of areas of agreement, I should say. And those criticisms, you know, I just wish he had acknowledged a little bit in the book that those criticisms have been made by other people who have, you know, who consider themselves on the left. Where I begin to worry, though, and you've already, Michael, said something that brought up my major objection to your line of argument, is, you know, you keep saying, well, the left hasn't succeeded. You know, we should succeed more. I agree we should succeed, but I think if we can't always think of succeeding in the same term, say, as the Democratic Party, the Republican Party does, you know, in terms of sheer numbers and popularity as measured by polls, we do have to take some unpopular stands. We do have to stick to our guns sometimes. Pardon the military metaphor. We do have to, you know, we put principle that over easy advantage in any issue we look at, and that means sometimes we are defending something which is unpopular. There were times almost any issue that we could talk about was totally unpopular, like reproductive choice for women, and it was a pretty lonely business advancing that in the early 1970s, for example, but we did, and we became the majority on it. I think the same is true with many of the other issues you raise now, like immigration and welfare, where we feel totally embattled. But this is ours is a moral crusade, not just a political headcounting type crusade.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with a lot of that, and I think it makes a lot of sense, and there was certainly we have to stick to our guns on. Let's take like gay rights is probably the most obvious example and the one that, you know, that the right certainly gets some mileage out of. But we can't, you know, we certainly can't retreat on that question. And I say in the book that I'm for gay marriage, and this is something that this is a position that the left has taken. And incidentally, in the book, I mean, I criticize identity politics, but I give it some credit too for having accomplished a lot of things and helped a lot of people. We can't back down on that. My objections are with sort of some of the strategies and some of the rhetoric used and some of the ways that we have gone about pursuing the goals. As I said at the top of the show, I mean, I'm completely in agreement with the goals, but my questions have to do with, you know, are there ways that we can pursue these same goals that maybe, you know, will help us win more people over to our side?
Now, can I quote you both on the fact that we should stick to our guns when it comes to gun bans?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I withdraw my metaphor.
We might be making moves today.
You may want to stand by it. Yeah.
Now, Barbara Ehrenreich, what about the whole debate over welfare? What do you think should be the message being put forward by progressives? And do you think that people have to rethink the approach that's been taken at this point?
Well, this is probably the area where I have the biggest sort of substantive and immediate disagreements with Michael Tomasky is, you know, I don't think it's a matter of identity politics or some sort of screwball leftism to want to defend an entitlement to welfare for poor single parents. That's what I do, and a lot of feminists are doing. Is that, you know, I think Michael has bought into a lot of the conservative arguments about welfare, that it just causes dependency and it causes, perhaps even causes poverty and so on. Here is an unpopular position, which both, you know, morally I am impelled to take and rationally I am impelled to take by a careful study of the issue. And I think, you know, Michael then would be right. The burden is on me then to connect this to the concerns of a lot of other people, which is what we try to do. We try to talk about how, you know, if you take away welfare, if you take away that bottom safety net for the low, you know, the poorest people, you are basically undercutting everybody. You're undercutting everybody in the workforce, because that's the big fear, of course, on the side of the employers, is that welfare could pay some people more than their pathetic minimum wage. So, you know, I think we disagree here, but I think we agree that there's a need to, you know, cast these issues in a way that a lot of people can connect with.
Michael Tomasky.
Yeah, I go along with that. And what you just said about, you know, making working people realize that there's an eventual effect on them in the welfare debate is something I can support completely. What I do think, though, is that, you know, most people on welfare would rather be working, right? They'd rather have jobs. There's no question about that.
They'd rather have jobs, and they'd rather have child care while they go to work, and they'd rather have jobs that pay enough so that they're
can
pay the rent and buy food.
But many people on welfare are women, and they have children, and they consider themselves working when they're just raising their kids.
Well, that's true, too. That's true, too. But
let's say, the great majority, you know, if we're talking of AFDC, we're talking about 100% or...
Yeah, right. Right.
Single mothers.
Yeah. But I do think that sort of in some ways the left just kind of got itself into a position, though, of opposing any proposal that has come down the road. And you know, there are a lot of things to oppose, certainly. I mean, you know, I hold no brief for the much vaunted bipartisan Lee, I should say, the Tommy Thompson plan. And, you know, I'm certainly not crazy, obviously, about the Republican rollback to the states. But, you know, I think that our responsibility then is to come up with solid proposals that you know, are much more compassionate than that, but that do, you know, see as a realistic goal, you know, helping people get jobs. And I think that, you know, this has happened in some places in the country. I cite in the book the example of the New Jersey plan. Now, it has that family cap thing, which I don't know about. And, you know, I mean, the numbers aren't clear on whether
or
not...
Explain what you mean by the family cap.
The family cap is no extra cash benefit when a woman has a second child. And that was the one that got headlines, the aspect of that New Jersey plan that got the headlines, and almost all the debate about the New Jersey thing centered around that, with the right generally saying rah-rah and the left generally saying, you know, this is awful. But the fact of the matter is the New Jersey plan had several other aspects to it that were quite generous, and that New Jersey's spending more money, and that there are signs that things are working a little bit in New Jersey with respect to this plan. It was done by an African-American state senator, Democrat, liberal, who represents, you know, one of the poorest cities in the United States, Camden, New Jersey. It wasn't done by somebody, you know, who was out to kill the poor. Just be a little bit more open-minded about these things. That's all I'm saying.
Barbara, we're going to get your reaction in just a minute. We're talking to Michael Tomasky, author of the new book, Left for Dead, The Life, Death, and Possible Resurrection of Progressive Politics in America. And Barbara Ehrenreich joins us on the phone, author of The Snarling Citizen and many other books. And she reviewed Michael's book in this past Progressive magazine, the latest issue. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, and we're still in the studio with Michael Tomasky, author of Left for Dead, and Barbara Ehrenreich on the telephone from Florida. Coming up in just a few minutes, we're going to be joined by the whole crew, the whole quartet of the Four Men, and we're going to be hearing some of their songs from Chicago to San Diego and back again. But we're going to continue this discussion now. Barbara, your response to Michael's critique overall about welfare and his support for the New Jersey plan overall.
Well, those of us who have considered ourselves sort of advocates for welfare have, you know, always talked about reform, meaning that, you know, but it would be expensive. As Clinton, the early Clinton, remember, he was going to put money into child care and job training and all those things, and he backed off because it would be much more expensive than welfare as we know it now. But in addition to that kind of reform to make it possible for people, women to move into work if they want to, we realize that this has been a program which is an amazingly important emergency stopgap for so many women. Women are fleeing abusive relationships, for example. What do? You go to the shelter and they sign you up for welfare because you've got to have some way of feeding your kids in the interim. What we see is that we're about to lose the entitlement to that kind of that emergency safety net, and that is, you know, that is really worth opposing, and it's an issue which I think, Michael, you'll see that if you read, say, the Now literature, the Now newspaper, it's something that women of all classes potentially see as their issue. So I don't, you know, I think in this case you've fallen a little bit too much for the very conservative critiques, rather than looking at what women, feminists, sort of feminists somewhat of the liberal or left-wing bent are doing.
I mean, actually, I think that that's a big change for Now, the National Organization for Women, in the last year or so, really taking on the issue of welfare in the way that they haven't over their 30-year history.
Yeah, I mean, we've had a terrible time getting anybody to take this issue seriously. You know, I really disagree with Michael that the left sort of is mindlessly pro-welfare in its modern form, in its existing form. It's been very hard to get people in the sort of traditional left to say, yeah, this is our issue, too, because I think the left traditionally in this country, at least the part of the left that I know and tend to interact with, is very much focused on the more sort of wage issues, which are extremely important too, have been associated with the labor unions and so on. It's hard to get the unions in that part of the left to really focus on an area which is poor women's needs. And if we've made progress, I'd like some applause for that.
Well, I do applaud it. I think that's good. But I mean, historically, though, it was the case in the 1960s that a big impetus of the left's attitude toward welfare, a big part of the movement was welfare rights and was to put more people on the rolls, to precipitate some kind of urban crisis, which happened, but not quite in the way that its proponents hoped and planned. So You know, there is, I think, some historical blame there. I would concede that today that's not, you know, happily and thankfully the strategy. But you know,
what do you mean that welfare was created to put that people who pushed for it was to create an urban crisis?
Well, Francis Piven and Richard Cloward were writing this in The Nation in 1966 and 1967, and I quote one of the passages at great length in the book. And the idea was that, you know, an expansion of the welfare rolls, a planned doubling of the welfare rolls, would precipitate an urban crisis, that the Democratic capital D elites that ran the urban centers would be unable to deal with, really, and that therefore it would compel the national government to concerted action on fighting poverty. Well, they were half right. The welfare rolls did double, but unfortunately the reaction was not quite what they had in mind.
Well, but the welfare rolls didn't double just because there were welfare advocates like Cloward and Piven.
No.
Encouraging people to sign up, poverty was increasing.
Of course not. Well, I mean, what happened was that the manufacturing base was leaving New York City and the other, you know, industrial cities, you know, and that's the main reason. And I say that in the book.
Does it surprise either of you, this report in the New York Times today, that during the first 2 years of the Clinton administration, the country's top 5%, their income has grown faster than at any time, in fact, faster than during the Reagan era, and that the income gap is increasing now more than it ever has? Is this surprising to you, Barbara?
No, I mean, Clinton has been he's been a representative of big business. I mean, I have a hard time distinguishing between him and Dole.
The one Clinton official who tried, when the New York Times did its big series on downsizing, and earlier this year, who tried to talk about these issues and bring them to public attention, Robert Reich, the Labor Secretary, was called on the carpet by Laura Tyson and Robert Rubin and told not to talk that way.
We only have a few minutes, and I want to ask you, Michael, since you are critiquing what progressive America has accomplished, if what your platform would be, what you feel that progressives should take on right now, what should be their strategy?
Well, I think work and wages, you know, and this downsizing thing are the big issues. I think that, you know, that's something around which, you know, a lot of people from different regions of the country and different races and different classes, working class, middle class, and poor, can potentially feel like they can connect to, because a lot of people, I think, are scared right now. And universal health care, I think, is another thing. That's one that will take a lot of hits and will be unpopular. As Barbara was talking about reproductive rights in the 70s earlier, and that's one that will take some time. But it's one that I think over the course of time we can rally a lot of people to.
How?
Well, by showing them that what's in it for them, that it's good for them. I mean, the particulars of single payer are particulars that poll after poll shows that people support in terms of what they want with their health care. You know, so maybe you just give it a different label or sell it a different way or something. But the particular aspects of single payer, the right to use any doctor, the cradle to grave coverage, are things that people like. And I also think, you know, taking on two of the biggest lobbies in this supposedly anti-Washington mood that the country is in, supposedly, maybe would also score some points.
Do you think it's possible that the reason for the difficulties on the left is just because of the power of the right and the money of the right? And that doesn't just include Republicans. It includes a lot of corporate Democrats as well.
Give money to Democrats as well, yeah. And I do mention that in the book. But of course, I mean, that's always going to be one of our problems. We're always going to be, you know, out-financed and, out-organized to the extent that organization is a function of how many millions of dollars you can throw into it.
Well, I'm confused. This is Barbara. I'm confused because, Michael, you sound like a leftist. I'd admit you to my little socialist cell or whatever.
Well, thank you.
And I hope that as you publicize your book, you won't be doing it just on the grounds that you're the only one with these insights, because you do have a lot of potential people with you. And I don't think you had to alienate quite so many of us with your book.
Well, I wasn't trying to do that. I was trying to get a conversation going, and so we're having one right now, aren't we? So maybe maybe that's a step in the right direction.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us, and I'd like to invite our listeners to join in this discussion. You can call us in our comment line, and we'll play some of those comments at 202-588-0988, extension 313. That's 202-588-0988, extension 313. Or you can write to us on email at democracy@pacifica.org. That's democracy@pacifica.org. You can also write to us, just send us a letter in the mail, and we're going to be reading those comments. We're going to be doing this more and more to get your comments in the show. You can write to us, and we're particularly interested in the direction you feel that progressives should be going in these days. And also, I want to know if you feel that we have the same old dichotomy between left and right. And let me put that to you two as our final question, and that is, do you think there is a breakdown in the division between left and right, Michael?
I do, and I think it's all still kind of up in the air. It's obviously a sort of an offshoot of the collapse of the Cold War, which kept the lines, I think, in much more sort of rigid focus. And I think that historically speaking, you know, having been 6 or 7 years since that event, I think that it's still kind of up in the air and the dust hasn't settled. But it's very interesting. You see it sometimes in particular debates like NAFTA, in which, you know, Pat Buchanan and the labor unions are together. And then, you know, you see it in, I don't know, all kinds of weird little circumstances. So it might be interesting to see.
Barbara Ehrenreich, are you finding allies you never realized you had?
No, I don't think so. I think the right-left polarization gets clearer and clearer. You know, certainly there are issues like abortion that can muddy the waters in some cases, but overwhelmingly, I've never seen it so clear. I mean, are you on, you know, which side are you on? The wealthy sort of robber baronry that seems to be running this place, or the people that are getting trampled underneath?
Well,
yeah, but
I think
just very quickly, there are a lot of people that we would think of as conservative, and they probably are culturally conservative, who also hate those people.
Thank you very much. Michael Tomasky, author of Left for Dead, and Barbara Ehrenreich, author of The Snarling Citizen and many other books. We'll continue the discussion. You're listening to Democracy Now! On to now The Foreman, When Hell Freezes Over.
Well, I don't know if you read about this, but the law of gravity expires soon. And Congress is working overtime on new gravity legislation that says you can stay on the Earth, that's okay, but if you haven't found a job after 2 years, you float away. Anyway, here's a song about a lot of other stories in today's newspaper that you may not have read about.
They installed a condom dispenser at the Vatican. Yasser Arafat said he'd never wear that hat again. Germans gave every Holocaust survivor a Mercedes-Benz, and the Tutsis and the Hutus made amends.
Hell froze over today,
and I made good on several debts I never thought I'd have to pay. They discovered Jimmy Hoffa in a houseboat on Lake Erie.
Someone proved conclusively the single bullet theory.
Was wrong. Woody Allen walked hand in hand with Louis Farrakhan. Face the Nation had Cindy Crawford and Bo Derek on. The Earth fell out of its orbit and careened into the sun. And Bob Dole ran for president and won.
Hell froze over today,
and I made good on several debts I never thought I'd have to pay. They awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor to Timothy Leary.
Someone proved conclusively the single bullet theory was wrong.
Uncle Sam made reparations for repressions great and small by creating a society with liberty and dignity and equal opportunity and justice for all. Well, that Earth Goddess program on Channel 3 went national. Iran and Iraq
became one country called Irrational. Every commuter in Greater Los Angeles learned how to ride the bus.
And the rich folks said, please tax the shit out of us. Hell froze over today.
And I made good on several debts I never thought I'd have to pay. They served something tasty and nutritious in a high school cafeteria.
Someone proved conclusively the single bullet theory.
Yeah,
someone proved conclusively the single bullet theory was wrong.
The Foremen here on Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, and they are all in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
Hi.
We've got Kenny Rhodes, Roy Zimmerman, Andy Corwin, and Doug Whitney. Well, how do you come up with these things? Roy, you're the speechwriter.
They come up out of me, really. Some songs sort of write themselves.
You just can't keep them down. It's more of a question.
You have to be there while they do that, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Do you feel one coming out now?
that may be a song. I'm not sure.
Well, I was just looking at your. I was looking at your CD cover, and you've got an endorsement from Ollie North that says, "A very weird group."
Yes, friends. That. This is a very weird group. We did his show. He has a nationally syndicated, commercial radio talk show.
You're not allowed to mention that here.
I'm not.
We didn't.
The word commercial is like...
No, Ollie North.
Oh, I see.
Ollie North's talk show.
He's a swell guy.
Quite the fellow.
Yeah. And he was quite the congenial host, actually. The hour before and the hour after we were on his show, he was doing his usual vitriol. But while we were there, he was quite congenial.
And actually told us, you know who else would like you? Gordon.
Gordon?
G. Gordon Liddy. He'd love you guys.
Well, do you feel a song coming out of you on Oliver North?
Ready or not, here he comes. Who's standing over in the corner on his head? Right where his president deserted him for dead. Who is the martyr who sports a purple heart or two? It's Ollie, Ollie of Scott Free. And who is the ham they couldn't ever get to squeal? Who's the banana overturned upon appeal? Who's that a-sloshing across the river to Washington? It's Ollie, Ollie off Scott Free. Who played hide-and-seek for a decade and a week? Who thinks the White House press corps should never take a leak? The pride of the Annapolis alums. Ready or not, here he comes.
Who had an army of his very own to train? Who knows the market price for lobster and cocaine?
Who could be fairer to international terrorists
than Ollie, Ollie off Scott Free?
And who was the idol of the Nicaraguan youth? And who's got a funny little gap between his truth?
Who learned to be dumb and call himself a freedom fighter?
Ollie, Ollie off Scott Free.
You may recall Ollie up against the wall, squaring his chin and baring his grin and kicking them in the cabal, and later on, contradicting George and Ron, daring his due, preparing his coup, and swearing they knew it was on.
Left, left, right, left.
Well,
left,
I don't know, but left, I've been told left, William right, Casey's left, trail is cold. Left, am I right or
left,
wrong?
All right.
Left, am I right or
left,
wrong?
All right. Who says it's people like himself he represents? Who says
they never found a shred of evidence?
Who talks like Barney
and makes his home in Narnia? It's Ollie, Ollie off Scott Free. Who played hide and seek for a decade and a week? Who thinks the White House press corps should never take a leak? The pride of the Annapolis alums.
Ready or not,
here he comes. Who's in position, packed and poised to take the hill? Whose picture's on the $35 million bill? Who's got the jacket deflecting all the flagging? Must be Ollie, Ollie off Scott Free. Who's earned his diploma?
And by the way, who's homophobic?
Ollie, Ollie off Scott Free.
And you sang this on Ali North's show.
He requested it.
He did.
He said, what have you got on me?
The whole thing. Yeah, he let you sing?
No, there's one line that he objected to. His producer told us that, Ollie, you would rather you didn't sing the line about lobster and cocaine. Could you change that?
What's that line?
Who knows the market price for lobster and cocaine? So we sang, who knows the market price for lobster and innocent civilians?
And he was fine with that.
And what's the next line?
It was into the chorus after that.
Yeah. International terrorists.
Oh, we just let the rhyme scheme go to hell.
That's right. the end of the song, the last lines of it, we just sang with our eyes closed in case they really were our last lines. It's an intimidating fellow.
The Foreman on Democracy Now! Will be back in just a minute. Talking to the Foreman, and they've got some great songs that we've been playing over the last few months, and they have a new CD out, or cassette, whichever you want. It's called What's Left, and there are songs about San Diego, songs about Chicago, the two conventions, Republican and Democrat, and you've got a Scorched Earth Day. What's that about?
Well, that's a little spoken word bit that starts off the whole album. It's not even us that performs it, actually. It's our assembly person in California, Sheila Kuhl. Happens to be the assembly person of all of us.
Good evening, young Republicans, and welcome to the first annual Scorched Earth Day celebration, sponsored by the Sons of Conservatism in cooperation with no one, actually. A couple of announcements before we get going with the entertainment. There's a white Ford Fairlane in the Lexus-only section of the parking lot. Don't get up, you've already been towed. Covert Operations is having a bake sale. They don't say where. And there's a meeting Sunday of the Elitist Club, Exclusionary Chapter, Xenophobic Subcommittee, and no one is invited. Okay then. Is the band ready? Good. Let's give a warm, reactionary welcome to the Foreman.
And this is Sheila Kuhl?
Sheila Kuhl is our assembly person in the 41st District in California. And as a matter of fact, she might be better known to your listeners as the actress who played Zelda on Dobie Gillis. Little trivial fact at this point, because at this point she's quite the firebrand in the California Assembly.
That little skit, whatever you want to call it, was the basis of Hidden Agenda?
Well, yeah, it's a thing. I used to perform that myself at our shows, and there was a little continuation bit of that bit that sort of spawned the lyrics, I guess you'd say, for Hidden Agenda. Now I've said that, you'll hear that the lyrics are quite conversational.
This is one of my favorite on your CD.
Jefferson walks in a bar with Newt Gingrich on his shoulders. Bartender says, who's the arrogant windbag? Jefferson says, that's Newt Gingrich. The bartender says, I was talking to Newt Gingrich. Is that a hidden agenda in your pocket? Are you just happy to see me? Are you moving on into the 50s? Do you hear Lincoln turning over in his grave? That's the Republican Revolution. Well, dear, mind control,
crashing. Traveling Republican salesman knocks on the door of a farmhouse, says, I got a flat tire while I was slashing your subsidies. Promises, come on in, but keep away from my daughter. In the morning he finds a salesman in bed with Rupert Murdoch. Is that a hidden agenda in your pocket, or are you just happy to see me? Are you moving on into the 50s? You hear Lincoln turning over in his grave. That's the Republican Revolution. Welfare, bank control, public broad bashing. Luther King had a dream that someday all people would be judged not by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. And I have a dream, except I'm not me, I'm Bruce Willis. And I'm taking over Cuba, and suddenly I can't remember my lines and my pants fall down. Is that a hidden agenda in your pocket? Are you just happy to see me? Are you moving on into the 50s? Do you hear Lincoln turning over in his grave? That's the Republican Revolution. Welfare, bank control, civil rights, public broad bashing.
The Foreman, Hidden Agenda. Well, Roy, you're the lead singer there. What about your start? How did you guys all get together?
Well, we met in a nightmare of Pete Seeger's, and then got together at the Brooks Brothers and bought our suits. I formed the group about, the idea is about 10 or almost 12 years old now, when I came across a record by a group called the Wayfarers. They were like minor lights in the folk era. And they had matching suits and the whole kind of upscale look, and yet they were singing songs about labor and songs about how hard it is to be a miner and that kind of thing. You know, just the juxtaposition of those two things struck me as funny. So I started the group about 4 years ago to do just that style, and then we steer ourselves into political waters.
It's expanded since then. In fact, now I think we're more about trying to turn listeners on, energize them, and inspire hope in an era when voter apathy is rampant.
So that's why you're all wearing these polyester plaid suits.
Correct.
That's right.
As your radio listeners can see.
Now, is anyone playing your songs?
Well,
we are.
Yeah.
What do you mean?
the label has been really good in trying to get them out there, but we're a hard thing for them to know what to do with.
Yeah, I can imagine. I don't mean people in their homes. I'm talking about radio stations.
Yeah, exactly. Well, they sent it out to all the typical radio stations, but they did a smart thing. I think they sent it out with a 10-foot pole. And they still didn't touch it.
But true to form, we've been getting most of our attention on talk radio, oddly enough.
It's not very odd, but you attack the Democrats as much as you do the Republicans, so
maybe
you could
not
say
as
you're
much,
equal
but somewhat, yes, yes.
Well, I particularly liked your song, Chicago, the love song to a Democrat.
Souring on the porch, while you sit here broke and stroke your family values.
Used to stand for something, now you sit for everything. Circling like a dove with no left wing.
Now the lights are out,
the heat is gone, you're living by the torch. Always thumbing through the cue cards, Bill and Al use.
Had to hog the children and put your mom and dad in storage while you gorge on the latest George.
And you're leaving today,
leaving today,
going to Chicago on a mission for the middleman.
Toward the wilting flowers in the vase, and the two cats in the yard have got their claws out.
Everything was easy in our very, 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 very fine house.
Fine house.
But the fire is doused, and now you're playing Faust.
And I don't mean the Randy Newman record.
And you're leaving today,
leaving today,
going to Chicago on a mission for the middleman.
You're cleaving today,
cleaving today,
and your rubbers are the wall and pay for a little man.
You sure can be a great big ass, but we love you.
You're the ass we love to kick.
You're the ass we love to kick.
Love to kick.
We love to kick.
Yeah, you're the
ass
we love to kick.
I really want to kick your ass.
Chicago, Love Song to a Democrat by The Foreman on their new CD, What's Left. I like this stuff.
Thank you. Good.
So are we the only ones playing it? I'm going back to this point now.
You're the only ones who like it.
You're just drumming that into our head.
No, it's just brand new. It just got released this week, this album.
Yes. We have high hopes for radio for this thing. Actually, really, I'd like to hear Hidden Agenda and some other cuts played on regular old radio. Not just the friendly radio like Pacifica.
Well, really, how do you come up with these songs, and what are you drawing from?
I subject myself to the usual news sources that everybody does, and certain things will spark for me. I don't have a Bosnia song. I don't have an Oklahoma City bombing song. Certain things just don't suggest themselves. I don't have a Dole song because it would all be one note. But certain things like school prayer, for instance, or public broadcasting suggest themselves as songs to me.
Well, now that you've suggested public broadcasting, how could we not? I have to admit we have played this before, but it's one of our favorites.
Good.
We're privateers of the public airways.
Beware, ye public broadcasters.
We're coming for to scuttle your scurvy membership. We'll be about as subtle as a sloop upon a slip. There ain't no damn rebuttal while button up our lip. Prepare to take a dip.
We're ravaging your culture.
We're pillaging ad hoc. Don't bother to consult your stars
or talk your dandy talk.
For yonder be a vulture circling with a budget hawk.
So down the planky.
Audio ho ho. Video ho ho, you're sinking fast, you'll never last, so stand up, ask ye knaves.
We're privateers
of the public airways.
We wear a patch of black over both our pirate eyes.
We'll cut you with a draconian saber down to size,
'cause we got our tobacco and our rum to subsidize,
not to mention shakes and fries.
We're raising up our standards so you can lower yours. We'll see you slashed and slandered and abandoned on the shores.
Then sail away to grander days and blander metaphors.
It's a beautiful day in the neighborhood.
Bring on the media whores. Audio, ho, ho, video, ho, ho. You're sinking fast, you'll never last. Another blast of our bombast. So stand up, astronauts.
We're privateers.
Privateers of the public airways. We've carved a bucket of blubber from every liberal lover.
And to the bottom, bottom, as we wish them pleasant journey.
We're gagging every elitist and every Sesame Streetist.
We're throwing Grover over.
And the same with Bert and Ernie.
We believe in the three R's.
R, R,
and R.
And your many miscellanies, they haven't made a dent. Can't stop a pirate when he's in a cutthroat sentiment. We're pinching all your pennies, cause we can't afford dissent. You'll like it at the bottom, cause that's where the First Amendment went. Audio, ho, ho, video, ho, ho. We'll split the thunder, rape and plunder, send her under and defund her. Hear the thunder of our blunderbuss.
We're buccaneers.
Prick up your friggin' ears.
May the market force be with ya.
Tough buccaneers to us.
Privateers of the Public Airwaves by the Foreman. You think you can get the singing senators to sing the song at the next Republican fundraising convention?
Yeah, we kick them in the butt. I don't know. That'd be good. Yeah. Sure.
Do you know who they are?
I've heard of them, yes.
Well, right. There are new Senate Majority Leader, Trent Lott, also Vermont, mm-hmm. Senator Jim Jeffords. And just about a week ago at the Republican fundraising dinner where Bob Dole said farewell the next day he left as Senate Majority Leader, they sang their songs.
Was this the same crowd that was in the production of 1776 about 4 months ago in D.C.? There was a one-night performance of that with a lot of congressional and senators in it.
I don't know, but on this night, they raised $8 million. Have you ever raised that after singing?
Wow.
No, and we have trouble raising glasses.
So where do you tour?
We spend a lot of time in Washington, D.C., as a matter of fact. Seems like a likely spot for us, and we've gone to New York several times. We haven't toured, you know, per se. We do, like, these little sort of surgical strikes and spend most of our time in Los Angeles.
You have an email address or website so that if people want to find out where you're going to be, they can
find
out?
Andy, why don't you spew that?
We have both an email address and a website, and folks want to check out the website. It's actually part of the Reprise Records website, links to a Foreman website. The address is all the normal http://www stuff .reprisereck.com, which will take you to the Reprise Records website, and then links to the Foreman. People want to email us directly. It's THE4 MEN, the Foreman, at AOL.
Are you actually on audio on the internet where people can hear your songs?
Yeah, you can download a little bit of that Ollie North show, as a matter of fact, and hear what his response was to our song.
Well, you're listening to Kenny Rhodes, Roy Zimmerman, Andy Corwin, and Doug Whitney, who all together are the Foreman. So what's your favorite? What would you guys like to hear? We like to make our guests happy.
I'd love to have you play Ain't No Liberal.
I saw a blinding flash of light, so I pulled over to the first church on the right.
And I feel so good,
ain't no doubt, I'll laugh and shout about
because I once was a liberal, but I ain't no liberal no more. I saw a bum on the curb today, hey! Well, I hit the gas and covered him with gutter spray.
And Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin, our engineer, Kenneth Mason. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Special thanks to Bill Wax, our director today, and to Mark Vivas. This is Democracy Now!
My heart is jumping and my head is swimming. I feel like I could take the vote away from women.
And I feel so good.
Feel so good about
ain't no
it.
Doubt.
Ain't no doubt
Wanna
about it.
Laugh and shout about it. Because I once was a liberal, but I ain't no liberal no more.
All right.
Hello, I'm Diane Rehm. Ridicule is the name of the game in today's politics, and if you are thinking about running for office, get ready. It's probably worse today than it was 40 or 50 years ago, but the question is how much worse? Making fun of elected officials is nothing new. Going back to the beginnings of this nation, we've used various forms of humor to highlight the failings and tear down the successes of politicians. Whether it's the cartoon nightclub humor, late-night TV shows, or syndicated columns, the joke catches on and gets passed around. Just what it's doing to the political process is another question. We've got four people joining us in this hour, and I'll look forward to hearing your comments as well. First, though, a news update.
Good morning, stations. Here's the Diane Rehm Show promo for Friday, June 21st in 3, 2, 1.
Friday on the Diane Rehm Show, a roundup of the week's top national and international news stories with Steve Roberts of U.S. News, Jody Allen of Slate Magazine, and Clarence Page of the Chicago Tribune, and speechwriter and policy advisor to John F. Kennedy, Theodore Sorensen. That's all coming up Friday on the Diane Rehm Show.
Okay, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
WAMU in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. Making fun of the president is nothing new in American politics. No administration going back to George Washington has been spared. But along with its entertainment value, political satire very often delivers a potent message. Joining me in the studio to talk about humor in politics today and its impact on our political